2. Born a Crime. I grew up in South Africa during apartheid, which was awkward because I was raised in a mixed family, well, with me being the mixed one in the family. My mother, Patricia Nombuiselo Noah, is black. My father, Robert, is white. Swiss German, to be precise, which Swiss Germans invariably are. During apartheid, one of the worst crimes you could commit was having sexual relations with a person of another race. Needless to say, my parents committed that crime. In any society built on institutionalized racism, race mixing doesn't merely challenge the system as unjust, it reveals the system as unsustainable and incoherent. Race mixing proves that races can mix, and in a lot of cases, want to mix. Because a mixed person embodies that rebuke to the logic of the system, race mixing becomes a crime worse than treason. Humans being humans and sex being sex, that prohibition never stopped anyone. There were mixed kids in South Africa 9 months after the first Dutch boats hit the beach in Table Bay. Just like in America, the colonists here had their way with the native women, as colonists so often do. Unlike in America, where anyone with one drop of black blood automatically became black, in South Africa, mixed people came to be classified as their own, separate group. Neither black nor white, but what we call colored. Colored people, black people, white people, and Indian people were forced to register their race with the government. Based on those classifications, millions of people were uprooted and relocated. Indian areas were segregated from colored areas, which were segregated from black areas. All of them segregated from white areas, and separated from one another by buffer zones of empty land. Laws were passed prohibiting sex between Europeans and natives, laws that were later amended to prohibit sex between whites and all non-whites. The government went to insane lengths to try to enforce these new laws. The penalty for breaking them was 5 years in prison. There were whole police squads whose only job was to go around peeking through windows. Clearly an assignment for only the finest law enforcement officers. And if an interracial couple got caught, God help them. The police would kick down the door, drag the people out, beat them, arrest them. At least that's what they did to the black person. With the white person, it was more like, "Look, I'll just say you were drunk, but don't do it again, eh? Cheers." That's how it was with a white man and a black woman. If a black man was caught having sex with a white woman, he'd be lucky if he wasn't charged with rape. If you ask my mother whether she ever considered the ramifications of having a mixed child under apartheid, she will say no. She wanted to do something, figured out a way to do it, and then she did it. She had a level of fearlessness that you have to possess to take on something like she did. If you stop to consider the ramifications, you'll never do anything. Still, it was a crazy, reckless thing to do. A million things had to go right for us to slip through the cracks the way we did for as long as we did. Under apartheid, if you were a black man, you worked on a farm or in a factory or in a mine. If you were a black woman, you worked in a factory or as a maid. Those were pretty much your only options. My mother didn't want to work in a factory. She was a horrible cook and never would have stood for some white lady telling her what to do all day. So, true to her nature, she found an option that was not among the ones presented to her. She took a secretarial course, a typing class. At the time, a black woman learning how to type was like a blind person learning how to drive. It's an admirable effort, but you're unlikely to ever be called upon to execute the task. By law, white-collar jobs and skilled labor jobs were reserved for whites. Black people didn't work in offices. My mom, however, was a rebel, and fortunately for her, her rebellion came along at the right moment. In the early 1980s, the South African government began making minor reforms in an attempt to quell international protest over the atrocities and human rights abuses of apartheid. Among those reforms was the token hiring of black workers in low-level white-collar jobs, like typists. Through an employment agency, she got a job as a secretary at ICI, a multinational pharmaceutical company in Bromfontein, a suburb of Johannesburg. When my mom started working, she still lived with my grandmother in Soweto, the township where the government had relocated my family decades before. But my mother was unhappy at home, and when she was 22, she ran away to live in downtown Johannesburg. there was only one problem. It was illegal for black people to live there. The ultimate goal of apartheid was to make South Africa a white country, with every black person stripped of his or her citizenship and relocated to live in the homelands, the Bantustans, semi-sovereign black territories that were in reality puppet states of the government in Pretoria. But this so-called white country could not function without black labor to produce its wealth, which meant black people had to be allowed to live near white areas in the townships. Government-planned ghettos built to house black workers, like Soweto. The township was where you lived, but your status as a laborer was the only thing that permitted you to stay there. If your papers were revoked for any reason, you could be deported back to the homelands. To leave the township for work in the city, or for any other reason, you had to carry a pass with your ID number. Otherwise, you could be arrested. There was also a curfew. After a certain hour, blacks had to be back home in the township or risk arrest. My mother didn't care. She was determined to never go home again. So she stayed in town, hiding and sleeping in public restrooms until she learned the rules of navigating a city from the other black women who had contrived to live there. Prostitutes. Many of the prostitutes in town were Xhosa. They spoke my mother's language and showed her how to survive. They taught her how to dress up in a pair of maid's overalls to move around the city without being questioned. They also introduced her to white men who were willing to rent out flats in town. A lot of these men were foreigners, Germans and Portuguese, who didn't care about the law and were happy to sign a lease giving a prostitute a place to live and work in exchange for a steady piece on the side. My mom wasn't interested in any such arrangement, but thanks to her job, she did have money to pay rent. She met a German fellow through one of her prostitute friends, and he agreed to let her a flat in his name. She moved in and bought a bunch of maid's overalls to wear. She was caught and arrested many times for not having her ID on the way home from work, for being in a white area after hours. The penalty for violating the pass laws was 30 days in jail or a fine of 50 rand, nearly half her monthly salary. She would scrape together the money, pay the fine, and go right back about her business. My mom's secret flat was in a neighborhood called Hillbrow. She lived in number 203. Down the corridor was a tall, brown-haired, brown-eyed Swiss-German expat named Robert. He lived in 206. As a former trading colony, South Africa has always had a large expatriate community. People find their way here. Tons of Germans, lots of Dutch. Hillbrow at the time was the Greenwich Village of South Africa. It was a thriving scene, cosmopolitan and liberal. There were galleries and underground theaters where artists and performers dared to speak up and criticize the government in front of integrated crowds. There were restaurants and nightclubs, a lot of them foreign-owned, that served a mixed clientele. Black people who hated the status quo and white people who simply thought it ridiculous. These people would have secret get-togethers too, usually in someone's flat or in empty basements that had been converted into clubs. Integration by its nature was a political act, but the get-togethers themselves weren't political at all. People would meet up and hang out, have parties. My mom threw herself into that scene. She was always out at some club, some party, dancing, meeting people. She was a regular at the Hillbrow Tower, one of the tallest buildings in Africa at that time. It had a nightclub with a rotating dance floor on the top floor. It was an exhilarating time, but still dangerous. Sometimes the restaurants and clubs would get shut down, sometimes not. Sometimes the performers and patrons would get arrested, sometimes not. It was a roll of the dice. My mother never knew whom to trust, who might turn her into the police. Neighbors would report on one another. The girlfriends of the white men in my mom's block of flats had every reason to report a black woman, a prostitute, no doubt, living among them. And you must remember that black people worked for the government as well. As far as her white neighbors knew, my mom could have been a spy posing as a prostitute, posing as a maid, sent into Hillbrow to inform on whites who were breaking the law. That's how a police state works. Everyone thinks everyone else is the police. Living alone in the city, not being trusted and not being able to trust, my mother started spending more and more time in the company of someone with whom she felt safe. the tall, Swiss man down the corridor in 206. He was 46. She was 24. He was quiet and reserved. She was wild and free. She would stop by his flat to chat. They'd go to underground get-togethers, go dancing at the nightclub with the rotating dance floor. Something clicked. I know that there was a genuine bond and a love between my parents. I saw it. But how romantic their relationship was, to what extent they were just friends, I can't say. These are things a child doesn't ask. All I do know is that one day she made her proposal. "I want to have a kid," she told him. "I don't want kids," he said. "I didn't ask you to have a kid. I asked you to help me to have my kid. I just want the sperm from you." "I'm Catholic," he said. "We don't do such things."
"You do know," she replied, "that I could sleep with you and go away and you would never know if you had a child or not. But I don't want that. Honor me with your yes so that I can live peacefully. I want a child of my own, and I want it from you. You will be able to see it as much as you like, but you will have no obligations. You don't have to talk to it. You don't have to pay for it. Just make this child for me."
For my mother's part, the fact that this man didn't particularly want a family with her, was prevented by law from having a family with her, was part of the attraction. She wanted a child, not a man stepping in to run her life. For my father's part, I know that for a long time he kept saying no. Eventually, he said yes. Why he said yes is a question I will never have the answer to. 9 months after that yes, on February 20th, 1984, my mother checked into Hillbrow Hospital for a scheduled C-section delivery. Estranged from her family, pregnant by a man she could not be seen with in public, she was alone. The doctors took her up to the delivery room, cut open her belly, and reached in and pulled out a half-white, half-black child who violated any number of laws, statutes, and regulations. I was born a crime. When the doctors pulled me out, there was an awkward moment where they said, "Huh, that's a very light-skinned baby." A quick scan of the delivery room revealed no man standing around to take credit. "Who is the father?" they asked. "His father is from Swaziland," my mother said, referring to the tiny landlocked kingdom in the west of South Africa. They probably knew she was lying, but they accepted it, because they needed an explanation. Under apartheid, the government labeled everything on your birth certificate. Race, tribe, nationality. Everything had to be categorized. My mother lied and said I was born in Kangwane, the semi-sovereign homeland for Swazi people living in South Africa. So my birth certificate doesn't say that I'm Xhosa, which technically I am. And it doesn't say that I'm Swiss, which the government wouldn't allow. It just says that I'm from another country. My father isn't on my birth certificate. Officially, he's never been my father. And my mother, true to her word, was prepared for him not to be involved. She'd rented a new flat for herself in Joubert Park, the neighborhood adjacent to Hillbrow. And that's where she took me when she left the hospital. The next week, she went to visit him with no baby. To her surprise, he asked where I was. "You said that you didn't want to be involved," she said. And he hadn't. But once I existed, he realized he couldn't have a son living around the corner and not be a part of my life. So the three of us formed a kind of family, as much as our peculiar situation would allow. I lived with my mom. We'd sneak around and visit my dad when we could. Where most children are proof of their parents' love, I was the proof of their criminality. The only time I could be with my father was indoors. If we left the house, he'd have to walk across the street from us. My mom and I used to go to Joubert Park all the time. It's the central park of Johannesburg. Beautiful gardens, a zoo, a giant chessboard with human-sized pieces that people would play. My mother tells me that once, when I was a toddler, my dad tried to go with us. We were in the park. He was walking a good bit away from us, and I ran after him screaming, "Daddy, Daddy, Daddy!" People started looking. He panicked and ran away. I thought it was a game and kept chasing him. I couldn't walk with my mother either. A light-skinned child with a black woman would raise too many questions. When I was a newborn, she could wrap me up and take me anywhere. But very quickly, that was no longer an option. I was a giant baby, an enormous child. When I was one, you would have thought I was two. When I was two, you'd have thought I was four. There was no way to hide me. My mom, same as she'd done with her flat and with her maid's uniforms, found the cracks in the system. It was illegal to be mixed, to have a black parent and a white parent. But it was not illegal to be colored, to have two parents who were both colored. So my mom moved me around the world as a colored child. She found a creche in a colored area where she could leave me while she was at work. There was a colored woman named Queen who lived in our block of flats. When we wanted to go out to the park, my mom would invite her to go with us. Queen would walk next to me and act like she was my mother, and my mother would walk a few steps behind, like she was the maid working for the colored woman. I've got dozens of pictures of me walking with this woman who looks like me, but who isn't my mother. And the black woman standing behind us who looks like she's photobombing the picture, that's my mom. When we didn't have a colored woman to walk with us, my mom would risk walking with me on her own. She would hold my hand or carry me, but if the police showed up, she would have to drop me and pretend I wasn't hers, like I was a bag of weed. When I was born, my mother hadn't seen her family in 3 years, but she wanted me to know them and wanted them to know me. So the prodigal daughter returned. We lived in town, but I would spend weeks at a time with my grandmother in Soweto, often during the holidays. I have so many memories from the place that in my mind, it's like we lived there too. Soweto was designed to be bombed. That's how forward-thinking the architects of apartheid were. The township was a city unto itself, with a population of nearly 1 million. There were only two roads, in and out. That was so that the military could lock us in, quell any rebellion. And if the monkeys ever went crazy and tried to break out of their cage, the Air Force could fly over and bomb the shit out of everyone. Growing up, I never knew that my grandmother lived in the center of a bullseye. In the city, as difficult as it was to get around, we managed. Enough people were out and about, black, white, and colored, going to and from work that we could get lost in the crowd. But only black people were permitted in Soweto. It was much harder to hide someone who looked like me, and the government was watching much more closely. In the white areas, you rarely saw police. And if you did, it was officer-friendly in his collared shirt and pressed pants. In Soweto, the police were an occupying army. They didn't wear collared shirts. They wore riot gear. They were militarized. They operated in teams known as flying squads because they would swoop in out of nowhere, riding in armored personnel carriers, hippos we called them, tanks with enormous tires and slotted holes in the sides of the vehicle to fire their guns out of. You didn't mess with a hippo. You saw one, you ran. That was a fact of life. The township was in a constant state of insurrection. Someone was always marching or protesting somewhere and had to be suppressed. Playing in my grandmother's house, I'd hear gunshots, screams, tear gas being fired into crowds. My memories of the hippos and the flying squads came from when I was 5 or 6, when apartheid was finally coming apart. I never saw the police before that, because we could never risk the police seeing me. Whenever we went to Soweto, my grandmother refused to let me outside. If she was watching me, it was, "No, no, no, he doesn't leave the house." Behind the wall, in the yard, I could play, but not in the street. And that's where the rest of the boys and girls were playing, in the street. My cousins, the neighborhood kids, they'd open the gate and head out and roam free and come back at dusk. I'd beg my grandmother to go outside. "Please, please, can I go play with my cousins?" "No, they're going to take you." For the longest time, I thought she meant that the other kids were going to steal me. But she was talking about the police. Children could be taken. Children were taken. The wrong color kid in the wrong color area, and the government could come in, strip your parents of custody, haul you off to an orphanage. To police the townships, the government relied on its network of impimpis, the anonymous snitchers who'd inform on suspicious activity. There were also the blackjacks, black people who worked for the police. My grandmother's neighbor was a blackjack. She had to make sure he wasn't watching when she smuggled me in and out of the house. My gran still tells me the story of when I was 3 years old and fed up with being a prisoner, I dug a hole under the gate in the driveway, wriggled through, and ran off. Everyone panicked. A search party went out and tracked me down. I had no idea how much danger I was putting everyone in. The family could have been deported. My gran could have been arrested. My mom might have gone to prison. And I would have probably been packed off to a home for colored kids. So I was kept inside. Other than those few instances of walking in the park, the flashes of memory I have from when I was young are almost all indoors. Me with my mom in her tiny flat. Me by myself at my gran's. I didn't have any friends. I didn't know any kids besides my cousins. I wasn't a lonely kid. I was good at being alone. I'd read books, play with the toy that I had, make up imaginary worlds. I lived inside my head. I still live inside my head. To this day, you can leave me alone for hours, and I'm perfectly happy entertaining myself. I have to remember to be with people. Obviously, I was not the only child born to black and white parents during apartheid. Traveling around the world today, I meet other mixed South Africans all the time. Our stories start off identically. We're around the same age. Their parents met at some underground party in Hillbrow or Cape Town. They lived in an illegal flat. The difference is that in virtually every other case, they left. The white parents smuggled them out through Lesotho or Botswana, and they grew up in exile in England or Germany or Switzerland because being a mixed family under apartheid was just that unbearable. Once Mandela was elected, we could finally live freely. Exile started to return. I met my first one when I was around 17. He told me his story and I was like, wait, what? You mean we could have left? That was an option? Imagine being thrown out of an airplane. You hit the ground and break all your bones. You go to the hospital and you heal and you move on and finally put the whole thing behind you. And then one day somebody tells you about parachutes. That's how I felt. I couldn't understand why we'd stayed. I went straight home and asked my mom, why? Why didn't we just leave? Why didn't we go to Switzerland? Because I'm not Swiss, she said as stubborn as ever. This is my country. Why should I leave? South Africa is a mix of the old and the new, the ancient and the modern. And South African Christianity is a perfect example of this. We adopted the religion of our colonizers, but most people held on to the old ancestral ways too, just in case. In South Africa, faith in the Holy Trinity exists quite comfortably alongside belief in witchcraft, in casting spells and putting curses on one's enemies. I come from a country where people are more likely to visit sangomas, shamans, traditional healers, pejoratively known as witch doctors, than they are to visit doctors of Western medicine. I come from a country where people have been arrested and tried for witchcraft in a court of law. I'm not talking about the 1700s. I'm talking about 5 years ago. I remember a man being on trial for striking another person with lightning. That happens a lot in the homelands. There are no tall buildings, few tall trees, nothing between you and the sky, so people get hit by lightning all the time. And when someone gets killed by lightning, everyone knows it's because somebody used Mother Nature to take out a hit. So, if you had a beef with the guy who got killed, someone will accuse you of murder and the police will come knocking. Mr. Noah, you've been accused of murder. You used witchcraft to kill David Kibuka by causing him to be struck by lightning. What is the evidence? The evidence is that David Kibuka got struck by lightning and it wasn't even raining. And you go to trial. The court is presided over by a judge. There is a docket, there is a prosecutor. Your defense attorney has to prove lack of motive, go through the crime scene forensics, present a staunch defense, and your attorney's argument can't be, witchcraft isn't real. No, you'll lose.